listening to Alan James on Circle of White Light Radio and People's Internet Radio, focusing on solutions and thinking different.
Good evening and welcome to Circle of White Light Radio with myself, Alan James. It's the 31st of July 2022. Good evening to everybody logging on the chat room there. I hope you're having a nice day. Weather's really warm, really nice. And I have to say, this is the kind of weather I like. Yes, I still have a little bit of the cough. It's still hanging on, but it's getting better. So that's the good news. My guest on the show is a lady called Max Lowen. And for some people, because of her background and experiences might trigger some people. So just a word of warning there, just be careful, because it's going to be got to do with sex slavery and sexual abuse and all that kind of stuff. So be aware of that. Okay, loads of things to talk about. So before we do that, let's find out what the communication channels are.
The communication channels are email, contact us at circleofwhitelight.com, by phone 046-927-1212, or sign up to our newsletter via our website at circleofwhitelight.com.
Okay, folks, you know where to find me, circleofwhitelight.com, also on Patreon /COWL and PayPal on the website as well. And if you're looking for T-shirts, if you want to support Circle of White Light Radio, you can buy a T-shirt. It's €10 plus postage and packing. Send us an email and we'll give you the details there. Right, okay, so just a couple of things to read out before we get my guest on. A message that was sent from the Hub that was posted up on Facebook. And basically, it's a bit of a heartbreaking message that was posted up there. And I'm just going to read it out because this is the state of things that are happening at the moment, and it's a bit of a concern, but it's affecting a lot of people over here in Ireland. And it's on a Facebook page called Support for Nurses, Midwives and Frontline Staff in Ireland. As the TDs leave for a summer break on their highly inflated salaries, I walked in on my husband with a noose around his neck this morning. He wanted out. He couldn't bear to see us suffer any longer. Both of us are nurses. We can no longer afford their mortgage of €250,000. We can't afford the longed for three children that we were blessed with. We can no longer afford food to feed myself and himself. We barely afford to feed our children. Neither of us drink or smoke. We work opposite shifts as much as possible to save on childcare, yet we're crumbling. We haven't gone on a holiday since before we were married. My husband, who saved lives, is so ashamed that he can't provide for us. It's just heartbreaking. I'm so ashamed too. I've told no one. We are failures. We are ordinary, hard-working people who are sinking rapidly. He isn't the only one dying. We both are. I want to go with him. The only reason I didn't join him in ending this is because I couldn't bear for our children to know how much we struggled. And also, I couldn't bear to leave them alone in this shitty, greedy, self-serving world. The cost of living is killing us. The government and the arsehole Greens in government are killing us as they boast about green walkways, etc. F me, we cannot afford food, for God's sake. She says, enjoy your holidays, Fianna Fáil, Fine Gael and the Green Party. I dread the idea that you could ever continue to rule Ireland and put more of us into early graves. No doubt you'll put many more of us into early graves and then clap yourselves on the back on TV for caring for us and for saving an environment that's already effed by countries such as South America, China and India. We can no longer afford to fill our cars with fuel to get us to work, Eamon. Congratulations on being so environmentally friendly whilst killing us. My husband is now getting treatment in hospital, thankfully. But it's just a matter of time before he feels he has had enough. I'm not there to find him, vice versa. I'm so sorry for my rant. Please forgive my bad language. I'm in the worst, absolute worst period of my life with no end in sight. This story is horrific and one of many, unfortunately, but we we all can help. We just have to realize that we all have the power and ability to help. And we do. We all have the ability to help. We just have to realize it. Another kind of story, and it, I know it's kind of more on the negative side, but another kind of story is independent.ie. Buy long life food now due to food shortages this winter, Supermax owner Pat McDonoghue says. The founder and owner of Supermax is advising people to buy long life food now as he fears there will be shortages this winter. Pat McDonough said the war in Ukraine is having a huge impact on food production, leading to a sharp increase in prices. His comments come as McDonald's today announced an increase in some items on its Irish menu, with a cheeseburger now costing 20 cents dearer at 1.70. Everybody has to get through it. We have to adapt to the new situation and deal with it, and it will level itself out, Supermax owner told News Talk The Hard Shoulder. I would be recommending people to buy a bit of long life food early. I do honestly think that people should stock up. I would be concerned though, in one sense, there could be a little bit of a scarcity of food towards the end of the winter, up towards December. I can't predict what happens, but I'm assessing it in my own way. So he's the boss of Supermax. And basically he's advising people to buy long life food and to start stocking up. Take it for what it is. We know what's going on. We know what they're trying to do. So I think it would be a good idea to, no harm for people to actually stock up and have an extra bit of food just in case, if you can afford it, because the price of food has gone up, as you know. So, but do what you can, you know, do what you can. Okay, my week, just a couple of things for my week. Thank you to the new patrons that joined up on Patreon over the week. They signed up support Circle White Radio and the people who have donated via PayPal. Thank you very much for that. It's much appreciated. As usual, the money will be allocated to donations. Most of it anyway, because there's admin costs, but most of it is donated to a worthy cause each month. And that's people power. That's how we help each other. I'm aware that for whatever reason, some people might not be in a position to get involved in projects. And I understand that. So what is the next best thing? Well, that is to support the people who are doing it. We can all sit around and wait for the funding to arrive, but we forget that we have the power. Imagine how many people we could help with the donations from Circle of White Light Radio if, say, 10,000 people donated €1 per month. €1 is less than the price of a parking ticket and a cup of coffee. So you do have the power and the ability to make a change and make things different. You just need to realise it. Whether you donate to Circle of White Light Radio or another group, it doesn't matter. As long as they are transparent and you can see where the donations are going. On Circle of White Light Radio, if you click on the paid forward menu option, you will see where the donations are going and who they are helping. This is people power in action. We have the power, folks. We have the ability to help each other. Forget about the funding, right, for a minute. We have the power to help each other. And if everybody, if you can't get involved in the project, as I said, because you're busy or there's something else going on, even if you donated €1, €2 to a worthy cause, that's going to help, making sure it goes to the right place, obviously. And that's going to help. And that's how easy we have the ability to do it. I think we forgot about that. And we are looking for the saviour or the funding when we can actually do something ourselves in a positive way. The other thing, during the week, just something that I was working on during the week, I finally got one of my solar panels set up and wired in. Everything was working fine, and a big thanks to Peter for donating 2 batteries to the project. Even though myself and Steve built solar generators a few years ago, I now feel it is better to be charging in real time with solar panels rather than using a trickle charger, which we did in the past. So when I get my mounting brackets for the next panel I have another panel, I'll be getting that up as well, which will give me more input power. The next thing to be upgraded after that will be the inverter, which is only I only have a 1,000 watt inverter, so I need to get a 2,000 watt inverter, which should cover all the devices in my shed, plus any emergency power in the house. So, again, handy having power backup, because the ESB, in their infinite wisdom, is having an actual power down on the 8th of August, which is obviously happens to be Lionsgate. Loads of energy is going around at that time. So that's going to be, that's going to be interesting. So at least I'll have some power, I'll have backup power, which I'll be able to use, which is great. Okay, right, time to bring my guest on. As I said, this could be a trigger for some people, so just be aware of that. Max is a survivor, a truth teller, healer, and advocate for children. Max shares her experiences as a survivor of satanic ritual abuse, torture, and sex trafficking within the Vatican and amongst the globalist elites. Her journey of healing and recovery and her work with trauma survivors illustrate the resilience of the human spirit and is a guide to how all of us can heal ourselves and come together to end the abuse of children forever. Max is a host of Unbroken, a series that both exposes the truth about the harvesting of children through the testimony of other survivors, as well as bringing solutions and stories of resilience and recovery. She is also the director of Child and Family Restoration Services, a new global agency devoted to ensuring children and families have the education, resources and help they need to heal, recover and thrive. Good evening, Max. How are you doing?
I am doing well. Thank you, Ellen, for having me on.
That's okay. I think, you know, thank you, Max, for coming on. And before we get into the subject matter, I just want to say thank you very much for stepping forward. And I know it's a kind of a challenge, and I know it's a very daunting to come out and expose what's going on. So it's your courage to do that has been fantastic. So I really appreciate that you've taken the courage to do that and talk about your experience.
Yeah, you're welcome, Alan. You know, the truth needs to be known in order for us to do something about it and find solutions. So I am willing to talk about my past just to expose this, because people really do need to know what the elite do to children so we can stop it.
Yeah, definitely. And as more and more, you know, gets exposed and we hear what's going on. I mean, before we get into your background, you know, if people are aware over here in Ireland, we know there's been a lot of child abuse, especially with the church, and things being exposed, reports have been exposed, things have happened with church and the priests and all that kind of stuff. And what they tried to do over here is lock them records away. I think the report was called the Ryan report. And what they tried to do is they tried to lock that report away for 75 years. Now, I would ask, who are the people behind that, trying to lock that report away? And the reason why they're doing it is because the people who are in that report are still alive today. In 75 years' time, they won't be, so it won't matter. So I think anybody who's part of trying to hide that report or trying to make that legal so it's all the information is hidden should be investigated straight away, because that's what's going on there. So just to let you know that, Max. But okay, Max, what we're going to do is we're going to start off and we're going to get a bit of your background. So tell us about, you know, how you grew up.
Yeah, well, my father is American. My mother is Italian. And due to my father's job, I grew up moving around the world. I grew up in Chile, in Lesotho, which is in Africa, in the Dominican Republic, Argentina, and my high school years in Italy. So I grew up trilingual, and the lifestyle was wealthy. It was, you know, skiing in the Andes and in the Alps, going to country clubs, private schools. We had big homes with household staff and often, you know, had cocktail parties and things that I was obligated to attend, where I would meet presidents of countries and dignitaries and people such as that. So that was essentially sort of the outer appearance of my life.
Right. Okay. And it's, as you say, you speak Spanish and Italian as well?
Yes. Yes. And okay. English.
Very good. Very good. Okay. So tell us, you know, How did it all come about? How old were you and how did it take place? I know you said that your uncle had a torture facility. But tell us, how old were you when things started to happen?
Well, yes, that's correct. The abuse came from my mother's much older brother, my uncle, who was the director of a secret torture facility. It's kind of military experimental type thing. Underground in Rome, and mind you, these facilities exist in every country. So actually when it began was shortly after birth. My uncle visited, and he did a what you might call an MK Ultra ritual when I was a baby. And what that would look like was I was in a crib, and he brought my mother into the room and sat her in a chair and tied her up and put a different series of masks on her with some lights. So it was dark, and then he would turn on a light onto her, and then different colored lights, some loud sounds, and then I would be swung around the room by my arm. And this kind of thing is done to break the attachment bond between, you know, my mother and myself, and this is commonly done. So that was an example of one of the first incidents. So I would have been just a few months old in that very beginning.
Okay, so questions are beginning to come to mind already. So where was your father, and why did your mother agree to this? Why didn't they just turn around and say, well, what are you doing? You're not, no, you can't do that.
Yeah. Well, initially, before my father was a diplomat, he was a Marine, and he had been sent to Vietnam. And so it was just my mother and myself at that time. And so my uncle came to visit. And so my father was not there to do anything. My mother was, I believe that she herself was put through this kind of thing as a child because she was not altogether well. She was either very, very depressed. And so, you know, I remember as an infant crying and crying and she would not come. Or if she did, she could be quite violent. You know, she could suddenly go into she has some split personalities, so she would go into a violent persona. And in my throughout my childhood, she tried to commit suicide several times, which I saved her from. So she was not, she was programmed, and so she was not really able to not only do anything to protect me, she herself was not well.
Right, okay. So she was obviously got to when she was young, and obviously that would explain it. And, of course, he came in, and he probably dictated to her anyway, and she did what she was told. Maybe he had something against her, or she, you know, something like that. I don't know.
Well, you know, and then you keep in mind, you know, throughout my childhood, all the things that were done to me, she was unable to do anything. So, for example, she became very so depressed after he visited when I was a baby that we moved at that point to Chile where her parents were stationed. And over there, my uncle came to visit over there as well. And when I was around two, he did this elaborate ritual in a small Catholic church with me. And, you know, my mother had to be there watching. And so in this particular ritual, I was laid on the altar, and a metal cross that was heated up was placed on my chest. And so I remember vividly the pain, but also that the smell of burning flesh that was all around me. And then I was put into a small coffin, and the lid was put on, and I would be left there overnight, you know, and they came back to get me the next morning. So when I think of my mother, I imagine I'm a mother myself, right? So I can imagine what she couldn't do anything, but she had to sit there and participate in these things. And the general gist was, you know, to burn a cross into my heart, you know, a cross is a binding symbol. It's, you know, it's taken, it's the light, someone of the light, like Jesus, taken and tortured and crucified. And so, you know, these rituals, they're very, it's basically to bring in Satan and to to frame me as evil as well. So that also would create this barrier between my mother and I. So you can imagine psychologically, it's very, very complicated.
Yeah, totally. And why you? Do you have a particular DNA or blood group, or was it just easy pickings for your uncle?
Well, you know, I do have a memory of before I incarnated into this lifetime, where I was at a meeting somewhere, and we were discussing planet Earth, and I scouted here a timeline, and, you know, there was the option that this would, you know, it would be destroyed. And so I remember in this memory before coming in that I volunteered to come here. And when I was a little older, around 5, when I lived in Africa, I remember once I was lying on the ground outside. It was nighttime and I was looking at the stars. And all of a sudden, I saw all these stars falling to the earth. And I understood that these were a group of people that I was one of, that I would find later in my life, that we had come here to help, to do something about the situation here.
Yeah.
So that actually sustained me throughout my childhood and kept me alive knowing that. But I think that many of us who come here, who have come here to basically be part of this transition now, have been targeted in one way or another. So I believe that is the case with me.
Okay. And that's interesting. And when you mentioned the Vatican, the link with the Vatican, obviously you lived in Rome or you lived in Italy. And that's why where the Vatican come in. Did you go back to Italy, or did the link with the Vatican happen when you were living over there?
So I believe my mother was programmed to do this. Every summer holiday and every winter holiday, no matter what country I lived in, she took us to Rome, and my father wouldn't go. And so once in Rome, my uncle, the one who had visited in some of the countries, he lived there, and he ran a secret torture facility that was under the ground in Rome. And it sort of had a lot of experimental technology and militaristic. And so he would take me there every time I visited Rome. And then when I was 14, my parents divorced and we moved to Rome full time. So unfortunately, from that age to 18, he had me all the time.
Oh my God. And you want to mention, obviously, the satanic rituals that took place. Tell us about them. What kind of rituals were they doing?
Yeah, so let me start, Alan, if it's okay with describing the torture facility for you.
Yeah, please do.
So, like I said before, these exist everywhere in the world. And so I think people should know this. And it was underground, and it had a sort of a white van rental kind of thing on the surface to make it look like, you know, it was something else. But within the facility, which was under the ground, it was huge. It spanned, you know, several blocks, and it included a morgue and, like I said, all these rooms with different tech and for experiments. It would there were these different rooms in the facility, and they had at least 2 or 3 sides of the room would be made of glass so people could look inside and watch the different tortures that were done. And all the rooms had a sort of a concrete floor with a drain hole and this big hose attached to the wall so they could rinse off, you know, the blood and the guts. And so in this facility, for example, they had this horrific section where they had animals, and I was made to walk through it. And for example, there was a baby cow. And I'm sorry, this is slightly horrific. So if you're listening, just prepare yourself. They had peeled this poor baby cow's skin off, and it was standing in a stall, and they were dripping acid on it, on its raw skin. And the baby cow was screaming. And each stall, each area had an animal in some kind of torture. So there was another one, there was a cat, and it was trapped in kind of a glass box. The bottom half of the box was filled with water. And then they made me watch while they lowered the bottom half of the cat into the water and dropped in piranhas. So the piranhas would basically eat the cat alive. And so, you know, to this day, I cannot stand animals suffering. This is how evil these people are. And they would have these freezers, these gigantic freezers, where they would hang either dead human bodies on these big meat hooks or animal bodies. And so I was often placed in these freezers for, you know, long periods of time with the dead bodies. I was also put through these psychological horror experiments. So one of them, there was these rooms had, there was one of the rooms that had a glass that I would face sort of, I could look into two rooms at the same time, one on my right, one on my left, and there was a panel. And I was brought in there. In this particular one, I may have been something like 10 years old. And they had a woman strapped in a chair in one of the rooms with a minuscule bomb in her mouth, you know, sort of tied around her face. And in the room on the other side was my younger sister in a similar situation. And so I would be given the impossible choice. And my uncle would say, well, you either kill one or the other. And if you don't choose one, I'm going to kill them both. And so I, of course, you know, it's a horrible no-win situation. And I chose to push the button with the lady. I could not, you know, kill my own younger sister.
Yeah.
And when I pressed the button, the woman's head exploded and went everywhere. And they took me out and into the room where she was and made me pose with my arm around her shoulders where there was no head and all this blood and everything. And they took pictures and laughed. And so this is just one, but I want to impress upon you that, you know, they enjoy this kind of thing. They think it's amusing. And the psychological torture for me was to make this impossible choice. And then my uncle would always tell me afterwards that I was a murderer. Mm. And, you know, it was to instill shame and guilt and make me feel like I was, you know, the one doing these things. He would capture gypsies. They are undocumented in Italy. And so he would kidnap children and adults and bring them in there and put them through horrific torture rituals that I was made to watch. So unfortunately, not just animals, but people. And at one, and this kind of cruelty that my uncle had, where at some point he said to me that he would bring a friend to me. I was, you know, probably kept in there for days at a time. And he had me wait in this room in the facility, and there was a giant fan, you know, the size, you know, of an adult person's height.
Yeah.
And he walks this girl down the hall for me to, you know, spend time with. And then right when they get there, the fan comes on and he pushes her through the fan and, you know, she splatters all over me. So these kinds of things and many, many, many more were things that I was put through in the torture facility, and also including, you know, being put in cages without food or water for days. And sometimes there were other children in the cages, and sometimes it was just me. But these were the kinds of things that they did in the facility. So
That was, I mean, that's just sick. I mean, it was said to me, Max, and listening to that horrific story and the things you've been through, it kind of confirms what was said to me, that these people are so sick that if they walk past a chip shop and they wanted to go in and there's a queue of people in there, they would throw in a hand grenade, kill everybody just to get at the top of the queue. And, you know, I mean, this is the definition of how sick these people are. And for people who have empathy, you know, it's very hard for them to realize how sick people are out there. And a lot of people have a habit of putting their morals on people. And they go, ah, sure, no, they wouldn't do that. And you think, no, you wouldn't do it. But just because you wouldn't do it doesn't mean they wouldn't do it. Because these people are psychopaths. And yes, they are sick people, and they just don't have the same brain system that we do.
That's correct. And, you know, so some of the satanic rituals will illustrate your point really well. And I know from other people that some of us, I've met others who have been through very similar rituals. So they like to do, you know, sort of the same kind of thing. And so one of them, I was around 14, and I was taken out to the woods somewhere at night. There was a giant bonfire, and they brought in cages full of live animals that were set near the bonfire. And I was laid down on a blanket and injected, drugged with a drug that I couldn't speak or move my body, but I was completely aware and could feel everything that was going on. And then a long line of men would gang rape me, you know, one after the other, after the other. And every time a man raped me, they threw an animal into the bonfire. So I would hear the screaming. And after that ritual, I became impregnated, and they did a ritualized abortion. My uncle waited till I was 6 or 7 months along. And then the ritual here was, we went to the home of, he worked with this guy that he called the doctor. And so we were at the doctor's place, and he had this courtyard with these small trees. And my uncle would set it up such that there was a table outside where my mother and my siblings and relatives were eating lunch. I was stripped naked and brought outside and nailed in each palm, kind of in a Jesus fashion. I was my hands were nailed to branches of the tree, and they put electrodes on my genitals and on my breasts. And I was, you know, pregnant. And I remember sweating in the sun, and then they would electric shock me. So I would pee all over myself. You know, I lost control of my bladder. And as I'm there being electric shocked, and, you know, I can barely move because, you know, the nails are tearing into my flesh, my family is sitting there having lunch as if nothing of this is happening, right? And this is part of the psychological torture. And then they took the nails out, brought me inside to the bathroom where there was a bathtub full of ice water. And I was handcuffed to the two faucets and then injected with something by the doctor and left there. And after a few minutes, I felt this horrible pain, and I saw blood in the water. And then I saw this very tiny baby float up. I was able to free my left hand from the handcuff, and I scooped up the baby out of the water. And, you know, we looked into each other's eyes, and then, you know, the baby passed on. Mm. But these are some of the rituals, you know, that I was put through. And, when you say they're psychopaths, they enjoy these things. And so I'll mention also the elite parties. I was taken to these parties. I would be blindfolded. You know, they would be out in some kind of mansion with acreage. And there would be a whole bunch of children brought there in cages. And in the ones that they had on grounds, they would let all the kids out of the cages and they would say that it was a hide and seek game. It was a hunting party, Ellen. Yeah. So the kids would run. We would all run and hide and hope that they wouldn't find us. And they would have a lot of fun finding the children. We would either be naked or sometimes dressed in special costumes, depending on, you know, what kind of party it was. And in one of them, I witnessed them take this long sword. And in the cages, there were two babies. They impaled both babies on the sword, and somebody was swinging the sword around and whooping and laughing as the babies, you know, the blood was going everywhere and the babies were dying. And at the end of the evening of the hunting, which they had a lot of fun doing, you know, they would find a child and rape the child. And then at the end of the party, there was always a sacrifice. So one of the children would be laid on a table and with food around the child and then cut open while alive, you know, on the table as the sort of the centerpiece. And these people do drink the blood of children. And they, if the children are small enough, they will take out the heart and some of the organs and eat them.
Man, you know, it's just incredible. And, you know, I was just thinking about the adrenochrome, but this goes way, way beyond adrenochrome. I have to ask the question, Max. Are these people, are these people human?
That is a really good question, Ellen. And I'm going to say no. So now let me tell you about the Vatican, and this will make more sense to you. So my uncle's facility, which was underground, was connected to these sub levels of the Vatican, and I would be taken there in a little train under the ground. And so underneath the Vatican, way down under, they have these rooms with these giant altars, and the altars have four corners so that they're designed in such a way so in each of the four corners, they had these elaborate golden chalices, and people would be there. It would be the popes and the clergy and other elites and people, and they would perform these rituals. So I was taken there to watch these rituals, and they would bring in anything from a one-month-old baby to a toddler. And they bring in the child, and everyone is standing around this altar, and there's candles, and it's dark. And they would lay the child on the altar and use a special dagger that they had, and they would sacrifice the child. They would start cutting right under the chin, at the neck, down to the solar plexus. The blood would go down the altar and fall, you know, would roll down into the four chalices, and they would, drink that blood as part of the ritual. And these rituals were to summon Satan and demonic entities. And I saw, so these people do this, and they invite these demonic entities to inhabit their bodies and take them over. So no, they're not human. And they deliberately do these rituals to not only to bring demons into this reality, but specifically to bring them into their own bodies. So I witnessed the demonic energy. They're not a shape exactly, but they look a little bit smoky. And the thing I can tell you, Alan, is the feeling was of us. I was so cold. It was so cold when that energy came through that I cannot even explain to you that degree of cold. It's in your bones. And so I did witness them doing these rituals to specifically bring in these demons into their body. And I believe my uncle did this and was inhabited by one of these entities.
Okay. And you reckon that that was his driver because he was taken over. I won't say a walk-in, but taken over. And I'd say probably by the sound of it, a lot of people who were involved in these rituals were all the same, were all taken over by some kind of entity.
Yes. You know, my uncle, when he was in the facility, he would wear a gun on his hip. And if someone displeased him even a little, he would just take out his gun, shoot them dead, and then snap his fingers and order it to be cleaned up. And so you can imagine within the family, no one dared to say a word to him. No one dared to oppose him, and no one dared to do anything about all the things he was putting me through. He had absolute control. And, you know, something interesting is some years ago, maybe four or so, I don't remember exactly, but my mother told me that he had been in a car accident, and he would have been around 90 at that point. And after the car accident, he suddenly was a different person. He didn't remember a single thing about his life. He didn't remember anything. It's like he went blank, and he's completely lost at this point. And so what I think happened is at the accident point, the demon left him. And so he was just an empty shell after that.
Okay. And out of curiosity, obviously you came across other children of probably the same age or similar age who've gone through this with you. Have you met any of them children who survived? Have you ever met any of them?
Well, you know, there were children brought to these different elite parties and into also in the Vatican, by the way, we would be trafficked out of there to elites, to clergy, to mafia people, to, you know, that kind of thing, government, Italian government people. And so sometimes I would see the same children to be brought to be sex trafficked in these, you know, sometimes I would be given out to somebody and I would be taken to their place. And I didn't know, you know, I was just gone for a few days and they, you know, while they used me in whatever the way they wanted. Other times it was at these parties. So at some of the parties, you know, there would be black tie and it would be in someone's beautiful home and everything. And then there would be all the kids. The pedophiles like certain genders, certain race, certain ages. So there would be a whole variety of children. And these people will go and pick the one they want and then take them to one of the rooms to rape them. So sometimes I would see some of the same children. Sometimes they would be different. You know, not all the children would survive those episodes. And but now, like in my adult life, you know, I would have no way of knowing where those children ended up. But I have met, I know about a dozen other people such as myself who have been through this kind of ritual abuse. And so I do have a group of people now that that we connect and you know, support each other, but they're not people that I knew back then.
Okay. And just out of curiosity, I mean, I think you're so lucky to get through this without them taking you out for whatever reason. Do you think because of your uncle, maybe even though in a twisted, sick kind of way, he didn't want anything to happen to you, as in being murdered, because for whatever reason, he had a sick reason for it. Is that why you survived, do you think?
Well, this is going to sound a little out there, but I was killed several times by some of the experiments and some of the abuse, you know, for example. They would study me, so they would take a hammer and like break all my bones. I had the ability to heal my body, and the times that I left my body and died, I would be given a choice to come back, and I would be shown, you know, what the future would look like and whether, you know, I was here or not. And so So I've had what people call near-death experiences, where you leave your body and you come back in. So all my childhood, I was very connected to Source God. So I was always talking to God. And so that sustained me. And so I wasn't meant to die. I mean, I could have not returned, but so no, he did. I mean, I did die a few times and I just was able to come back into my body, which is what made them study me after that. So then I was studied and put through all these different things to see how, you know, I would respond. And I know that sounds out there, but I have actually met other people who share a similar experience. Now, what my uncle did tell me all the time is that he was obsessed with me, and he would tell me that I was going to be just like him. I was going to be his right hand. And when he said that to me the first time, I was quite small, and I vowed in myself, never, ever will I be like that. And so what sustained me is I have a side of me that's very, very defiant, and I'm a warrior, you know. And so I refused everything in my being, knew that I would not let this man break me because I knew he wanted to. And so that gave me the fortitude to resist. And when I was a teenager, you know, I've only shared with you a few tortures and a few rituals. There's so much more that was done to me. And by the time I was a teenager, you know, I became more angry and more, you know, I was sick of it. And so when he would do a torture when I was a teenager, I would say, "Ugh, is that all you've got? You're boring me. You're just starting to repeat the same things. Can't you think of anything new?" And now that would get me more, you know, that I would be punished for that. However, it's hard to explain, but I think you can understand. It's like that spark of me. I had to do that to retain myself, right?
Yeah.
And so I think that's why I survived.
I think you get to a point where no matter what they do, your rebellious side kicks in.
Yes.
I mean, that's just horrific. Tell me something. You know, I've talked to people about the whole idea of soul contract and everything else. And we talk about the soul contract that we have, that we've come down here to learn certain things and do certain things as part of our growth and reincarnation and all that. And when you say to people who are not familiar with any of that, you kind of, oh, how can you turn around and say that a child will come down here and be abused? I mean, how can they agree to that? So speaking to you directly, because you've been through it, how do you perceive the whole soul contract? I mean, do you think that, you know, you, for whatever reason, signed up to this and said, right, I'm prepared to go through this because I have to learn X, Y, and Z? Is that your belief, or what's your belief on that?
That is my belief. I, you know, like I said earlier, I did volunteer to come here. And so I see it as we all have a mission in this lifetime. We're all here. Anyone who's here right now is here for this transition time because we have won the war against these dark ones, these Satanists. And so I think one of my missions when I was smaller was literally, I had this understanding when I came in that the balance, I remembered, you know, when I was a child that I'd come because the balance of light and dark had gotten very distorted. And the dark, usually it has to be in a good balance, but the dark had really taken over. So in one way, one of the things I did, I feel, is I ate a lot of the darkness. I was in the darkest places on earth. The Vatican is the darkest place on earth, right?
Yeah.
So I ate this darkness, and, you know, then I would excrete light because it wouldn't turn me. And so, and then some of the more horrific memories, you know, I repressed and I held inside me until in my early 40s when they came out. So it's also like if you take some of that darkness and you contain it, it's not out there, right? And so, and then I transformed it and transmuted it. So that's something that we all have the power to do. And so, yes, I believe that that was one part of my mission. And then I also believe that I was to survive so that I could find others like me, which I have, you know, such as yourself, Alan, yeah, such as Kim and the people at Life Force, and that I'm here to be part of this transition and part of creating this new reality going forward. And also, you know, a few years ago before I started my show, Unbroken, I was mad and I was telling Source God, you know, people need to know the truth. They need to know the truth. And then I heard, okay, well then tell them, right? Mm. So that's why I started my show. And, you know, I admit I was terrified to go on camera. I was scared to speak out, but I saw that as another thing that I was here to do, and is to tell my story and expose what these people do to children.
Well, I think you're very brave for doing it and coming forward. And I wish more and more people actually did that and we exposed them, because this is global. This is not just in one or two countries. This is global, and I'm sure it happens yes. over here. And I want to talk to you about human trafficking and sex trafficking, because that's going on globally. It's a massive, massive market for a lot of elitists, you know. And obviously we had the Epstein issue. You know, we know that story very well, and Epstein Island and all that. Tell us yeah. what your experience is and knowledge of the human trafficking and the sex trafficking globally.
Well, my experience with it as a child was that I saw children being trafficked out here and there and everywhere. And I was actually taken from Italy to New York and to Washington, D.C. to be trafficked as well. So that part I saw. And, you know, as an adult and having, you know, learned much more, what I know today is about 8 million children a year go missing and are being trafficked. And the entire planet, Alan, is set up to traffic children. So, for example, in the United States, we have an agency called Child Protective Services, or CPS. That agency, you know, ostensibly exists to protect children, but it's not true. It's created to traffic children. So they will take children out of their homes for alleged abuse and things. And then those children there's a menu. And so the elites, for example, here in the United States, the elites who are in the politicians and the presidents and all that high level people, they will have like basically a menu. Oh, there's a child of this age, of this gender, of this race, and they can order them, and they are supplied from the from Child Protective Services with these children to rape and harvest, and then, you know, they're returned, or sometimes they're not, they're killed. So the entire global structure, you know, we're talking the United Nations, we're talking, you know, all these global organizations, governments, so-called protective agencies. We have the Tavistock Institute, which was created decades and decades ago for this reason as well. So everything works hand in hand to traffic children. It is, I think, the second most profitable industry after war.
Wow. And it's been going on. And there's a lot more trafficking going on, not just on the planet. Well, I think we've talked about that before on previous shows. There's other kinds of trafficking going on. Jupiter Ascending. Have a look at the movie Jupiter Ascending. It'll give you kind of an idea if you haven't watched that movie. So, you know, needless to say, there's a lot of America isn't the only country that would have the CPS. And there's other countries, and Ireland's no different, that will have their own version of CPS. And I can't make any assumptions. Obviously, you know, allegedly, you know, I know there's a lot of people that are dealing with child agencies over here in Ireland, and kids are being taken, and people have said that certain agencies over here in Ireland are not fit for purpose because they're not doing what they should be doing. And I believe the family courts are closed shop. You can't have anybody in there. So it's all, again, to control the family. And maybe, you know, do what they've been doing in America and other countries as well. So, and the thing is, people know, I mean, when you ask people and you say, do you know that there's things, you know, there's human trafficking and sex trafficking, they fundamentally know it, but because it doesn't affect them, you know, it's not in their face and it's not on the TV, they kind of, oh, well, yeah, it's one of them things. And, they know now because of the things that you've talked about on the show tonight, and the horrific experiences. And this is not just child abuse or sexual abuse. This is satanic abuse. And,
right.
You know, the things they're doing in front of you to traumatize you, it's just unbelievable. I mean, I don't even know where to start. Where do you start to try and heal from something like that, Max?
Well, before I answer that, Alan, I want to say to your point, you know, it is sometimes in people's faces, but people don't see it. So, for example, the Catholic Church. I was raised Catholic. I was trafficked out of the Vatican. When I was, trained to do like the first communion, when you're in church, you have communion. Well, they're telling you right there, you're eating the flesh and drinking the blood of Christ, right? Mm. They're telling you that they eat and flesh and drink blood. That's right there in the open. It's just that people don't connect the dots. And then you might have things like supposed, like they call it, quote, child marriage. Okay, no, that's not child marriage. That's rape of children. Mm. There's no such thing as a child and marriage. Those things don't go together. Mm. But it's legitimized in much of the world. So there is legitimized pedophilia out there. It's just, it is kind of in plain sight. I just wanted to make that point before I answer your question.
Okay, well, I have a couple of questions, because some questions lead on to other questions. And I have a couple of questions that I scribbled down here. What if they are looking for a particular child because they, you know, for whatever reason, they want a particular child, and that child decides that they're going to fight rather than just not be subservient to them? What do they do? Do they traumatize the child first? Do they beat the child? Or what do they threaten the child? How do they get them to conform?
Well, if the child fights back, they drug them. Just simply, they drug them. And, you know, when a person is traumatized, and mind you, in a weird way, I had more of an advantage because some of these children that were trafficked with me didn't go home after the trafficking. They remained in the cages and they would die, right? So when you traumatize a person over and over and over again, they fragment, they break, they split. Mm. And that is psychologically protective because, so imagine if you throw a rock at a mirror and then it fragments into little slivers, right? And so each sliver of a person's that has been split will hold some of the reality of the trauma. But to survive, you have to have amnesia and dissociate from what just happened, because otherwise the horror of it and the terror of it will kill you. Mm. So it does kill some children outright. But those that survive, they dissociate. So sometimes it's also, you know, the children aren't all there when this is happening and they cannot really fight back because they're fragmented. But in terms of children who will really fight, they simply drug you.
Okay. That's it, because I was just wondering, because obviously this kid's going to be fighting back. Now, the other famous person, and I'll say the other famous person because, you know, people are getting to know you, which is really great, and your story, is Cathy O'Brien. And she said that, again, her brain was compartmentalized for this reason. And she mentioned that one of the people that abused her was President Ford. And I was just going to ask you, was there anybody in your travels that you recognized from a famous point of view that was, you know, can you mention, or can you, even if you just say, yes, I've seen them, but I can't mention a name, just to let people know?
Yes, a very limited, like two people that I can remember. So there were so many, and there's so much craziness and trauma that, you know, the most important thing is what your mind focuses on, and who they were was not the most important thing. So, but it's also possible that I may still remember more of it, you know, and there's still think maybe there's people that are in my mind that I haven't remembered. But I'd rather not name names for a variety of reasons, because I want the focus to be on what these people do. But what I can say is think of the Hollywood actors and actresses. Think of anyone who's a politician, a president, a high-level military, not low-level, but the higher ranks, the generals. Anyone who runs any global agencies, anyone in the religious world. So, you know, the big churches, the Catholic Church, the Mormon Church, you know, as an example, in the Mormon Church, you know, they are polygamous and they marry, they get all these wives. Well, some of the wives are 12. So that's, again, that's pedophilia in plain sight, right? Mm. So these are the general categories of people who would have done this. And I know a survivor who has identified, and this is not just men, by the way, has identified an American female high-level person who, let's just say, ran for president at some point. That's what I can tell you.
Okay, well, we've heard the story of Hillary Clinton and her lesbian lover and the video that was apparently put out there. Some of the actual American police in New York broke down and cried when they seen what he did to this young girl, actually stripping the skin off her.
Yes.
And that video is actually going around, and you know, I didn't see it, but I was told about it. And this was Hillary Clinton and her lesbian lover. I forget the girl who was the who that girl was, but she was in politics anyway with Hillary Clinton.
Huma Abedin.
Huma Abedin, that's right. Now, for people who've seen the movie Taken with Liam Neeson, that's more real and of reality than you think, of people being stolen and kidnapped, not held for ransom, but used as sex slaves, and even more severe. And this is why you have to be careful. Everybody has to be careful, especially when it comes to kids.
Yes.
You have to be careful because this is going on. Where is your uncle now? And out of curiosity, what rank was your uncle?
He is still alive. He is in Rome. I believe he's about 95 years old. But like I said, there's no one in there. The last thing I heard from my mother is that he was peeing in a teacup. He's completely lost his mind. There's no one inhabiting that body. He's completely, you know, done. As to his rank, you know, I don't know. But what I can tell you is, he was very close with the top people in the Vatican, the mafia, and the Italian government, which essentially is one big organization. Mm. And so he was a part of that group of people. He did the torturing and the experimenting for them.
Wouldn't you love to know, when he passes on, what his fate or his karma would be, you know? I mean, I know people say, and the soul contract thing is that, you know, we're all in a soul group and the person who loves you the most will be the person to do the worst to you when you come down here because they love you so much because you're going to learn from it. But, you know, it just doesn't sit with me. I have to kind of get used to that, you know. But look, I have a couple of questions here, and so I'm going to read them out, and then you can give us your feedback on them. John wants to know, has Lisa's uncle ever been brought to task for a satanic practice?
No, he has not. You know, let's be realistic. Who among them even today has been brought to task? Yeah. Even Epstein, who was arrested allegedly, right, or put in jail and supposedly committed suicide, he's living free in Iceland. These people, at this point so far in our history, have never suffered any consequences, none of them. And if it looks like they did, it's staged.
Yeah, exactly. And, well, hopefully, we hope that this is all going to change sooner rather than later, based on the information that we have from Kim and the team. Okay, next question from CXZR. Said that he wants to know, how did you escape from all of this?
Mm-hmm. So my father, because I'm an American citizen, there was always a plan that I would attend university in the United States. And so when I was 18, I moved to the United States. Now, An incident happened when I was around. I graduated high school when I was 17, just about 18. And my uncle had done, at this point, I was really, really done with his stuff to the point, I mean, I know this sounds horrible, but to the point that that degree of evil and darkness was almost boring. You know, it was almost just, I was so done with it. And he had done, he liked to do these Jesus rituals, and he had done something. And at a certain age, around 16, I had told him that, you know, you will not touch my younger sister, my mother, you know, none of this, or you know, I'm not going to stand for that anymore. Yeah. And so he did. He interfered with my sister. And I became extremely enraged. And I, you know, all those years and years of abuse, I just, this power went through me. And out of my mouth, and I remember this, his face, you know, I was so angry that actually wind started to happen, almost like a little mini tornado. Like there was this energy that came out of me. And I essentially, in my head, I got this information that it's almost like I understood that this was a contract or this was an agreement, and it was done. It was over. So I said to him that you will never do this to me again. I said no, basically, which is, in my opinion, the most powerful and most underused word in our world is no. And so I basically drew a line, and the power that was coming out of me with that rage, I saw in his face, you know, he took a step back, and I just said that that's it. I'm done. And he came to my high school graduation, and he gave me this, I remember, this leather kind of folder thing, and told me to open it. And when I looked in there, there were some, he basically said in there that you're a killer and you will always be a murderer. And it was his last, I recognized in that moment, it's like some transition happened, and I was able to see that as powerful as he was, and we're all so afraid of these powerful, dark people, but in that moment, I realized, wait a minute, there's more power in the light. I have an equal amount of power in me. And so I left, and he didn't try to stop me. And I think that whatever I did, it was like I said, that's it. We're done. I'm not doing this anymore. And once I came to the United States, that was it. They didn't come after me anymore after that.
Okay. Maybe he found somebody else to torture and to and go after that. And your sister, how's your sister? Do you see your sister? How did she work out? I mean, is she okay?
No, unfortunately, she is not okay. She has, like my mother, always been suicidal. She has not been able to function in life. She was, you know, someone who stole and lied and, just was not, I don't have any contact with her or anyone in that family at this point, because they didn't make it. And for some reason I'm strong enough that I did. But no, so we don't, unfortunately, no, I tried for many, many years to help her and it didn't work. So I have basically do not have any contact with any of them. And, you know, I just want to say something about suicide, which occurs to me right now. So these elites, when they torture and everything, they program children, right? And so you've probably heard that elite children are programmed to either be assassins or, you know, honeypots or psychics, and they put different programs in the children. And one program that was put in me was that if I ever told my story, I would commit suicide. And when I was in therapy and I was telling my therapist what had happened to me, this program opened up in a ferocious way, to the point that I would drive to the train station and stand on the platform and watch the trains go by. And in my head, it would say, jump, jump, jump. And I would resist it, right? But that's how powerful it was. And I had the strength to not obey those programs, but not every child, you know, so my sister did succumb to, you know, unfortunately to that kind of thing.
God. And the programming with NLP and God knows what else. Unbelievable. Unbelievable. Okay. Another question from Joan. Does Max know if any children that survived this horrific ordeal become like their evil tortures?
Yes, some do. You know, if you think about, for example, anyone who, for, let's say the person who assassinated John F. Kennedy or Lincoln or anyone like that, these are people who are taken as children and they're programmed. And then they get given a code word or a trigger or something. And then because, to program a person, you torture them, you abuse them until they shatter and fragment. And then when they're fragmented, it's very easy to mind control and program. So you can program a fragment, for example, to a mission like, okay, you're gonna assassinate this person when we tell you. And then the person can go on and seemingly live a life, but then in a moment that can be triggered and they will go and do something. They will go into a different part, a different altar, and they will execute, say, an assassination. And then maybe they'll flip back into a different part of themselves and not even realize or know what they've done. So
the Manchurian candidate, basically.
Yeah, and actually, you know, they tell us what they're doing. It's part of free will. They're supposed to tell us. So they tell us through movies and shows, and then we think that this is just fiction. But a really good one is The Bourne Identity.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, I have to. You know what? I have tried to sit down and watch that movie, but every time I go to do it, I get distracted or something happens. So I'll have to sit down and watch the movie from start to finish and have a look at it. Okay, another question from TZ on the chat room. This whole sector of the subject goes off-world. And what do you know of this aspect in your opinion? What are your own contact experiences, if any?
I did see a small gray in my uncle's facility in the morgue once. So I do know, and like I said, they bring in demonic entities in their rituals. So there is absolutely an element that's off-world. I don't know this from seeing it, but I know this just more as an adult, that the sex trafficking trade definitely also has extended off our planet. So, you know, there's all those stories of people getting abducted and, you know, I believe that a large segment of children, yes, are probably shipped, have been shipped off planet to be abused somewhere else.
Yeah, it doesn't surprise me. Again, people, if you haven't seen the movie Jupiter Ascending, have a look at that movie and it'll give you an idea. And it's all about consent. They tell us what they're going to do before they do it and it's up to us to say no. But a lot of people don't get it. And it's amazing how many people, the horrific nature of what they do with the satanic rituals and you sitting and watching it, them making you watch it. And you mentioned it earlier in the show. And yet people just seem to be not able to accept it. They just cannot accept that there's people on this planet who are that sick and more. And they've heard the stories. I mean, things like this have been in the news. It's not as if they've been completely sheltered. But again, it must be something got to do with compartmentalization in their own mind just to protect themselves. They don't want to believe it, you know?
Well, the difference between us and the psychopaths is, see, our heart is online. And when you can feel, human beings, we have mirror neurons. We feel each other. That's why if you watch a sad movie, you know, and something's happening, you will cry, right? You're just watching a movie, but you're empathizing and you're feeling what the other person, even on a screen, is feeling. That's our true nature. We're loving beings. And so I think it just hurts too much to accept this reality. It's way too painful to even, you know, allow oneself to consider it. But what people need to understand is these people are psychopaths. They do not have a heart that is that works the way ours do. And they have most often traded their soul for a demonic entity. Mm. And so that this is what evil does. And so, you know, it's hard to accept, but these people are not like us. Alan, they enjoy inflicting suffering, and, you know, they enjoy flesh and blood. They cut children open. They cut them to pieces. They eat them. They burn them. They rape them. I mean, and this is for them enjoyable. I know this is hard to wrap a human mind around this reality, but this is what we're dealing with. This is the darkness that has run this planet for a long time, which is ending now. But these people are not like us. You cannot think of them like you think of normal human beings, because they're not.
And they cannot be brought back from that. It's not as if they'll go in and they'll sit down with a counselor and be cured. It's not going to happen.
No. And they wouldn't want to. No. They've already made that choice. So yeah. No, they would not be fixed.
Of course. CXZR wants to know, are these people concerned about karma or something? They could obviously just kill you to stop you from speaking.
They're not concerned about karma because they're told that by doing these things, they are going higher in power and rank. And so in their minds, they are going to be rewarded for what they've done rather than punished.
Yeah, and their arrogance would probably not. They're not bothered about you speaking out because...
Oh.
And everybody else, because they just think, oh, well, we're winning, so it doesn't matter. Although they don't realize that they're not winning, you know, but they're just being told that they're winning.
They see us as cattle, as slaves, as a subspecies to them.
Yeah.
They think of us as, I mean, and if you think about it, right, human beings have cattle on ranches, and, you know, you let your cattle roam around within an enclosure, right? Mm-hmm. So here we are roaming around in each of our countries, but there's a border that we can't get out of. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, you take care of your cattle, you feed them and whatnot, because they're your source of food, right? So they've allowed us to exist here because we have been a source of food, not just physically, literally with the blood and the flesh, but, you know, with Lush, with etheric feeding on the fear and the negative emotions that they create. So they don't see us as like them. You know, it would be like, personally, I can't kill anything. Even bugs, when they're in my house, I trap them and I release them outside. But if anyone's ever squashed a cockroach under their shoe, that is the way they see us.
Yeah, and that's the thing. We are not at the top of the food chain, and people have to realize that. I do want to touch base on, you know, the positive side now, and you're growing and getting away from this. And obviously, you're a mom, and you have a children, or you have a child, yeah?
Yes,
so
I have a daughter.
How, with the horrific experience you went through, how do you differentiate, or how do you compartmentalize? Because obviously you met your husband or your boyfriend or your partner, and you obviously got into a relationship and you had a child. How did that not affect you with your experience from your younger days?
Well, it did, in the sense that so I had my daughter late in life. I was 39 years old. She's 19 now. And you know, after I gave birth to her, so even the birth itself, Alan, so this is how, at the time, I didn't remember that ritual abortion that I told you about that had been repressed because it was too horrific to remember until a certain point. And so after, when my daughter was about 4, I began to have severe nightmares where I would wake up screaming and sweating. And they weren't really nightmares. It was the memories coming back. So the interesting thing is, when I was giving birth to my daughter, I didn't remember that ritual abortion, but my body did. So I was in labor 26 hours. I was pushing for 4 hours, and she would not come out. And what I realized later is my body was not going to let her come out because part of me was afraid that somebody, that they would kill her. Right. Mm. And so I had to have a cesarean in the end because my body would not let her out. Mm. And then, you know, they put you in the room and they had these little rolling plastic bassinets. And I remember the nurse was, and I said, no, I need to hold my daughter. And so I had her on my body and I wouldn't let her go. And then they came in and took her to do the, you know, whatever they, the little things that they do, the nurse, and then they bring the child back. And when they took her, I started to scream and cry. And my husband was lying next to me in the hospital room. And he says, what, what? And I just kept saying, they killed her, they killed her. I didn't even know why I was saying that, Alan. No. But it was, this is how, so I was affected by the things that happened to me without really remembering at that time what had happened to me. And then when my daughter was, you know, a baby, I was very protective of her. I quit working because I was too, I had to be around her. I had to make sure that she was safe. I'm glad I did that. I was a full-time mom until she was 17. And, you know, it's the best decision I've made in my life. But I made it actually out of trauma, out of not trusting that she would be okay with anyone. And so, you know, when she was around 4 is when I got into therapy and a lot of the memories, you know, began coming back. But the on the other side of this is having my daughter and raising her in a safe manner. And she, you know, she was happy. She had her friends. She was playing. I sent her to a very good little private school. And so raising her and having her thrive and have a normal, good childhood was itself one of the ways, one of the healings for me.
And, you know, I think it's understandable, and everybody would probably say the same thing, that the life that you had and the things you experienced, it's only obvious that you're going to be overprotective with your child.
Yeah. Yes.
You know,
yes.
I mean, parents generally, like I'm a dad, and I'm, my son's 21, and I'm quite protective over him. And, but the fact that your background was so horrific, it's understandable that you'd be the way you are. And how was your husband? I mean, how do you kind of start the conversation when you go dating with your husband, getting to know him, and you go, by the way, this is what happened in my life? I mean, that's something to take on, you know?
Yeah, you know, I didn't say it right away. At some point I did. And my husband is a very gentle soul, very balanced, very straightforward, very kind, and kind of quiet, you know, kind of low key. And so he listened. And years later, he told me, I said to him, you know, you never said anything. And he said, you know, what can I say to that? I just listened and I heard you, you know, and so he's been able to just hold it. But I don't live in that reality, Alan. You know, once I left and I was 18 and I came to the United States, I started out in Washington, D.C. You know, I went to university and then eventually I got a master's degree and worked on a doctorate after that. But when I was in university, when I was young, I was free. It was this incredible feeling of, oh my God, I don't have to live under this crazy, dark torture anymore. Like I was, so what, the way I took it, you know, people react differently. The way I reacted was to go wild. So I was doing the partying and the friends and the dating and the studying and, you know, I threw myself into life because I had not really been allowed to live. Yeah. And so when I look back now, I'm 58 now, and when I look back on the years between 18 and roughly 38 when I got pregnant, those two decades I spent almost like trying to be a normal person and living a normal life. So I put it all out of my mind. And I just wanted to experience life, and I did, you know, and I got degrees and I became, you know, a psychologist, and I did a lot of work with trauma. So, for example, I started out right after college working in a psychiatric hospital with people who were psychotic and schizophrenic. Mm-hmm. And then I ended up working in the inner city with people who were homeless and addicts, and they were trauma survivors. I ran a program for batterers, for men who commit domestic violence, and I did men's groups. I worked in the jails and prisons doing trauma groups at a rape crisis center and then with abused children. And so all these things that I did with people, you know, people used to say to me, well, how could you work in such places like a prison or like an inner city? Well, that's nothing compared to what I saw. Mm. And it actually being able to help people with that, with trauma, was another part of my healing. Because when I was in that facility and people were being tortured around me and animals and babies and adults, I couldn't do anything, right? Yeah. I was powerless. Yeah. So now I have the power and the agency to actually help people recover from trauma. That was a huge part of my healing for me.
Brilliant, brilliant. Well, before we get into your healing, your work and your mission, just one more question from Joan, just talking about the actual things going on over here in Ireland. She says, people here in Ireland, when the abortion referendum was passed, people got physically excited at the thought of being legally able to murder a baby. Are these psychopaths satanic like her uncle, if you understand her?
Well, this, you know, all this abortion stuff, both sides of it, you know, it's controlled opposition. They create both sides of the problem to create two separate groups. But the whole idea of abortion, I mean, of course, they've become emboldened in the last decade or so. You can see that all the things that they always were doing, they're not hiding anymore. So now they're so emboldened. I believe I heard somewhere, maybe it was New York, and don't quote me on this, I'm not entirely sure this is correct, but I think I heard that they legalized abortion up to 28 days after the baby is born, right?
Yeah.
Well, this is their agenda in full view. They're not hiding it anymore. They love to murder babies. And they, you know, when they do abortions, the later term ones, you know, they use those body parts in rituals so these people love blood and guts and flesh. And so does abortion have a satanic element? Absolutely.
Wow. There you go. That's quite, you know, quite horrific to hear that. And I'm sure there's something that we need to do about that, because there's obviously a hidden agenda behind it. Let's get on more on a positive note. Let's talk about your healing work and your mission at the moment. Obviously, you have a show on UNN, and tell us all about that.
Yeah, so, you know, for me, people have different opinions of this, but for me, psychotherapy helped me a lot. It provided me with the different fragments of my story that kind of didn't make sense, and then some of the pieces that I recovered. I was able to kind of put my story together for myself and know where everything went. And there's something healing about that, about integrating, right, and not being so fragmented. And then the relationship that I had with my therapist, she was very non-traditional, of course, you know, to work with someone like myself, you can't be too traditional in your work. And so she actually would, normally if you go to therapy, you see someone once a week or so, and she would be available anytime I needed to talk to her because the memories were coming up. And so it was the relationship with her that was so healing, because I finally had someone who was consistent, who heard me, who believed me, who cared about me, and who was there for me. And so, you know how if you build a house without a foundation, it's not going to be very solid. Mm. Well, I didn't have a foundation in attachment or trust, which babies, that's the stages you go through. Attachment is the most important thing a human being has to their caregivers. And that basic trust and that sense of safety and agency, I didn't have that. I grew up sort of without that. And so going to therapy was like a reparenting and establishing for the first time a sense that I could trust another human being. So that was very, very healing for me. And then when I was processing the things that were happening, you know, I would cry, I would sob, I would scream. I ended up buying a plastic children's bat so I could hit my bed over and over because, you know, you can imagine the amount of rage that's in there, right?
Yeah, from totally. All that.
And then, you know what I did, Alan, is I took up boxing. So for 10 years, I went to a boxing gym. I learned the art. I punched and punched, and then I learned kickboxing, so I also kicked. And that was another therapy, literally, for me, because when you're being, raped and abused, you have no control over your body. So this was like a sense of, I have control over my body and I'm using it and I'm fighting back. I could never fight back, really. And so here it was like my body got to do what it never could do before, right? And so not only did it get out some of the rage, but it was very, very empowering. And then I was when I went to my doctoral program, it was a very alternative graduate school in San Francisco. And, you know, I studied shamanism and altered states of consciousness and astrology and things like that. And so I decided at some point I went on my own. I went to the Amazon jungle in Peru, and I lived there for about a month with a tribe, that lived there. And I did ayahuasca ceremonies with the shamans. And so I was looking for healing, right? And so that kind of thing also delivered a kind of healing that was different. So I'll just give you one example. In one of the sessions, I found myself traveling, you know, outside of my body. My body was in the chair there and I knew it, but I suddenly fell on a hardwood floor and I stood up and I realized that I was in my home in Buenos Aires in Argentina, where I'd lived several years. And it was not that I was remembering being there. I actually was there. I could see the furniture. I could see the hallway. And then I saw myself talking with my mother standing there and my mother's face. And she was yelling at me and angry. And I saw myself take in this idea that my mother hates me, which is what I always thought. You know, she doesn't love me. She hates me. And then I watched her turn and go into her bathroom and look in the vanity mirror. And I was behind her, you know, walking. And I looked in the mirror and I saw a section of her past. And I suddenly understood in that moment, she doesn't hate me. She hates herself. You know, this is her own darkness. It has nothing to do with me. So right there, I unhooked a huge piece, right? And that was a profound healing right there, you know. And then, you know, having my daughter and being able to, you know, raise her the right way and have her thrive and be happy and be healthy, I can't overestimate how important that was. And like I said a few minutes ago, helping other people, I think for everyone is an enormous healing when you've been through this kind of stuff.
Definitely, big time. And tell us about your show on UNN. Tell us what that's all about and what you do on that.
So I think it's been a year now, maybe, or maybe a little bit less than that, where, like I said earlier, I was telling Source, you know, people need to know the truth. And Source said, well, then tell them. So the first episode was my story. It was an interview of me. And then I came up with the idea of calling it Unbroken because, see, we can be broken in this life, but we can all heal and become unbroken. And then I started to interview other survivors. And then that sort of shifted into people also interviewing people about their awakening stories and their journeys through life. And everyone on this planet has been traumatized to one degree or another, right?
Yeah.
So through people's stories, we all learn. And then I also interview healers of all different kinds. And so I talk about trauma, what it is, being triggered, reacting, all these kinds of things, and then give people tools, like how do we manage our trauma? How do we come back? You know, what can we do? And so it's both an exposing of the truth and also offering healing and solutions of various kinds. So actually today, on Sundays when each episode comes out every Sunday, and so today there's an episode where I interview a man, a beautiful man who does structural integration work. And he talks a lot about how trauma can distort the body and how we can fix that, right? Mm. So that's kind of the gist of my show.
Very good. We will get to your links and everything shortly. There's a question has come in, and I don't want to kind of, it's more kind of on the negative side, but it's just TZ wants to know, we know there are many underground military bases and are aware they are used for this in this respect. What are you aware of them and any connections that you came across regarding them?
Yes, I'm aware. Like I said, the facility that my uncle ran had a military component, and these exist all over the world, and they're underground, and there's tunnels to everywhere, you know, airports, Disneyland, you know, they traffic underground. And so, yes, this exists everywhere. However, the good news here is, you know, if you follow Kim Gogan, she has actually destroyed most of these underground facilities. So there's less and less and less of them every day.
Brilliant stuff. Well, that's good news. But we have to leave on a good note anyway, and that's where we want to go. So when you're what do you recommend to people? Obviously, people who've listened to the show tonight, they could have been triggered by the information that you talked about. What do you recommend they do if they're anyway triggered or anyway upset about this? What do you suggest?
Well, when we're triggered, what it is something that we've seen or heard or been told is it hits something already inside us. So if you're triggered by something, you have a sort of a corresponding wound in you, right? And like I said, we've all gone through some kind of, you know, trauma, however small. And so I see being triggered as an opportunity to heal. So how do you know what you need to heal that's inside you? We call it shadow work, right? We call it inner work. What's in there that you're not aware of that might be influencing your life, your thoughts, your choices? Well, if you get triggered and something opens up, when you get triggered, you essentially go into the past. A hologram opens and you're feeling all these things. And so what I suggest to people is, first of all, feel your feelings, because our emotions are there to heal us, to cleanse us. So if you need to cry, or then cry, let that out of your body. Or if you're angry, just scream, you know, pound something, go punch a punching bag, let the emotion out. Then tell yourself, okay, so I've released that, and then put, I call it reframing. So I always put a different thought in my head. So the cabal has given us this program, which is victim, perpetrator, savior, right? So we can get stuck in those. So if you hear something like this and you know, you're starting to feel powerless and in a victim state, you know, which people can go there. Oh my God, this happens in the world. This is so horrible. Okay, you can feel it for a minute, but then don't stay there. Decide that we're all so powerful, Alan. And I guarantee to everyone listening, you came here on this to be in this lifetime right now to change this reality, to make it better. So, and don't feel despairing. Understand that we're in an incredible moment in the history of this planet where we have won the war against the dark. And I know it doesn't look like it out there. You know, there's all kinds of, because the old structures are falling apart and the truth is coming out. So it looks really ugly, but that is the death before the rebirth. It's the death of them. Right.
Yeah.
So take faith and do your little part. Sit with yourself in meditation and ask yourself, Why did I come here? What can I do about anything in this world, any issue in the world? And so, you know, Alan, in addition to the show Unbroken, I created the Child and Family Restoration Services. It's an agency. And so people have stepped in to help there. And we're doing things like, there's initiatives like Feeding the World, where we have resources for people, how to grow your own food in different environments, in different locations, you know, how to create co-ops or community gardens, how to find farms that you can subscribe to, how to enrich your soil. Like, there's that aspect of it. There's an aspect of trauma training, where I'm going to create roughly 3 to 6 month trauma training, which will include the nervous system, and it will include the psyche, it will include consciousness and things like that, so that anyone out there doesn't have to go to school for a bunch of years like I did. Everyone should know what trauma is and how to heal it. So I'm creating a course that healthcare workers, teachers, anyone working with people can take this course and learn. And we're going to have resources on there for things like that. We're also doing, one of the initiatives is education. It's so important to educate adults and children both, but also adults, you know, in things that can help, whether it's nutrition or cooking or trades or pregnancy or parenting or how to heal from your addictions, how to heal from your trauma. And then we're also having a section, an initiative where we're going to create these recovery centers for rescued children, for rescued animals. We're going to create models for community centers for housing the homeless, veterans, people who get out of prison, single parents. So one of the things, so I'm mentioning this because, see, we can do so much. And the website is going to come out literally within the next few days. It's going to be simply childandfamilyrestoration.global. And, you know, anyone can join and help. So when you feel despaired about the things that go on in this world, remember we are all the lights that have come here to change it and step into our power. And my best thing that I ever did that makes me feel good is to do something about it. Just do something. Whatever it is that you can do, do it.
Okay, very quickly, how do you get a good counselor? Because what you went through was just unimaginable in most cases. And I'd say most mainstream counselors probably would go, yeah, you know, I understand, you know, child sex abuse and all that, but the whole satanic thing, yeah, that's a bit wild. I mean, how do you pick your counselor? Just for if people are listening to this show and they feel that something in their life, they need to talk to somebody, how do you pick a good counselor who will listen? Is there anything you look for?
Well, you know, that's a really good point you bring up. And one thing I want to say is, in the field of psychology, and this is the opinion of other mental health professionals such as myself, they don't teach much about trauma. So I trained separately from school in trauma. There's not a lot of therapists out there that understand how to work with these more complex issues. And there's always been movements to discredit what's happening, such as in the 90s, they had that False Memory Foundation, where they're claiming, you know, that therapists are implanting these ideas in people's heads and this stuff doesn't happen. So you have to remember that the field of psychiatry and psychology, through the Tavistock Institute, along with the military, they created some of this mind control and fragmentation and the use of trauma to, you know, program the population. So that doesn't mean that you throw out the baby with the bathwater. But no, my field has not been, you know, has contributed to the problem. And not people, many people are trained and are wonderful therapists, but they would not know what to do with, for example, a satanic ritual abuse survivor. Mm. So one of the things that I'm working on right now is I want to create a database of professionals that do know how to work with this kind of thing and have that on the Child and Family Restoration website. So actually, if I can put this out, as if anyone listening to this is such a person who does know how to work with that level of trauma, You know, they can get in touch with me and I can talk to them and add them to the database. I have to answer your question by saying there's not a lot of therapists out there, unfortunately, who know how to work with this. And so, you know, I can't exactly tell you how to find someone, but what I would say the number one thing is if you're go to a therapist, is check them out. Sit there, talk to them, do a session or two, and see how you feel. Do you feel that they are connected to you, that they're, you know, it's really from the inside that we always have to vet things. So a person can have 10 beautiful degrees, but they may not really be the right person for you. So my first advice would be think out of the box. Also, the person I went to had a master's in divinity, was not in psychology or counseling, and she was able to help me. So, you know, it's really, and I guess what I would leave it with is, if you need healing, put that intent out there. Talk to source and say, I want to find the right person for me. That is the very first step. Mm-hmm. Because if you ask, you shall receive.
Brilliant. Well, Max, we've reached that time. A big thank you for coming on. Thank you for having the courage to come out and expose what's going on. It really takes a lot of energy and time and courage to do that. And just a big thank you for doing it. Do you want to give out your links to so everybody can pop over and listen to your shows and tune in to what you're doing?
Sure. So the show is called, my website is unbroken.global. And when you go on the website, there's some episodes that are free and others that you would have to subscribe to United Network News, to UNN, to watch the show. And that subscription, I believe, is about $6 a month. And there's actually really great content, other content on that show, on that website, that people can avail themselves of. So unbroken.global for the show. And for child and family restoration, it's childandfamilyrestoration.global. That website will be launched within this next week. So you can look to that. And if anyone wants to get in touch with me, they can reach me at max@unbroken.global.
Fantastic, Max. Thanks again for coming on. Just stay with me there for a minute. We'll go off to your musical break and we'll be back after this.
Okay.
Shout, shout.
You're listening to Alan James on Circle of White Light Radio and People's Internet Radio.
There you go, folks. That was Max Lowen. And if people were triggered by that information, by all means, I would suggest going and seeking a counsellor and talking to them, because it's horrific what she went through. As you heard, if you heard the interview, just horrific that what she went through, satanic abuse and the things they did to her. It's just unreal. But it has to be exposed and it has to be said to let people know what's going on in the real world. You'll never hear this on mainstream media. You really won't hear this on mainstream media. So, you know, somebody has to do it, I suppose. And I don't mind interviewing people and getting them talking about it. One of many, not just me, I'm sure there's other shows as well that are doing it. But the great thing is that Max has turned her life around and she's now helping others and doing her own show and talking about it. And that's the whole thing, you know. Kim was on the show last week, as you know. And I was on a little bit of a soapbox. But the thing is that we have so much power as people. And we can do so much. And even if we can't do it, we can support people doing it. And yet people just don't take the energy to think about it and go, yeah, actually, what can I do? Rather than, I can't do it. What we should be thinking is, what can I do? Even a little bit. And even if you can't do anything, support the people that are doing it. That's it, really. That's it, you know. And, you know, it's you know, everything's energy, as we know. Everything's energy. Even to think about things is energy. And I always refer back to the story in my early days in the corporate world when I went into the boss and I just had a problem, you know, a technical problem. And he said to me, he said, you know, Alan, he said, I'm not a techie, but if you give me 3 solutions, I'll pick one. And I learned from that. So in the future time when I had a problem, instead of going to him, I would think of 3 solutions and I would pick the best one myself and not even bother going to him. And that's the trouble, because to think takes energy and takes time. And unfortunately, there are people out there who just won't use the time and energy. They want the answers handed to them on a plate. They want the solutions handed to them on a plate instead of thinking, well, how can I do it? There's Max. Look, you know, the horrific life she's been through and everything she's done. And she's turned it around and she's doing fantastic work now. You know, so we all have the ability to do it or reach out to people who might help us to be able to do it. But we have to take the first step. And if everybody, like a piece, is a piece of the jigsaw and we all do our bit, you know, the world will change. We will switch it around. And I see it happening. I think more and more people are beginning to see it now and get involved and do it. Obviously, you're going to have a percentage of people who won't do it. But I think the majority of people will. Say 60% maybe will do it. And, you know, that's what we need to see. We are the people that are going to be the saviors. We're going to save ourselves. There's no savior out there. We can save ourselves. And that's really what Kim was talking about as well. We are our own saviors, you know. We just need to realize that we have the power. That's really it. Okay, my guest on for next week is a lady called Sarah Jane Smith. Sarah was on the show before, I think last year, the year before last. And she gave me a reading during the week, which is quite interesting. Good information coming in. And also, Siobhan Brady is going to be my co-host on the show as well. Siobhan hasn't been on for a while being a co-host, so it'll be good seeing Siobhan again. So we'll have a good old chinwag with Siobhan and Sarah Jane next week. Thanks for everybody who tuned in. Thanks to everybody in the chat room, all the chat going on there, and all the questions. Well done to everybody. Thanks a lot for logging in. Much appreciated for your support. And we'll see you next week. If you have any interesting information, by all means, email over to me or contact us at circlewhitelight.com. Otherwise, take care of yourselves. Have a good week. Enjoy the weather. Hopefully the weather's going to be good. And we'll see you next week. Take care and bye-bye.
You have been listening to Circle of White Light Radio on circleofwhitelight.com, focusing on solutions and thinking different.